The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Am I on?
Yes,
I'm great. Good morning. So the last, week or so, a lot of the discussions I've been having with people have been around the topic of relationship and how relationship is part of our practice and the creation and formation of wise community and wise friendships is really a big part of our practice. I think some of the way we emphasize the meditation here, close our eyes and go inside, it can make the whole practice, or the majority of the practice even, feel like it's about navel gazing, turning inward. And there is an aspect, there's definitely, we need to get familiar with how we are, because how we are impacts our relationships and our communities. But when I've been reflecting on this topic, thinking about this question, I brought one of the texts from the Buddha here. There are stacks and stacks of these. I think, there'd be three or four stacks this high if I were to bring the entire set of teachings from the Buddha in here. And a lot of what the Buddha talked about in these teachings has to do with community and relationship. So he really did emphasize this as a part of our practice. And so I wanted to explore some of the ways that he did that, using some of the words that he used. And, the first piece that I'll bring in is that one of the fundamental or foundational teachings that the Buddha offered is the Eightfold Path. And wise understanding, or wise view, wise intention, which is our framework or our orientation towards how we, our purpose or our direction in our practice. And wise intention brings in relational qualities of kindness, of non-harming, of compassion. So the beginning of the path in this Eightfold Path right there brings in the relational. And then the next three sections of the Eightfold Path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, are all about relationship. They're all about our activity in the world, the way we speak to other people, and how we engage with our livelihood. Again, very relational. The last three sections are about effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And there's a way that the effort, mindfulness, and concentration is directed towards understanding and learning about what's happening in here. But the teachings of the Buddha don't keep it exclusive to what's happening in here. In the Satipatthana Sutta, for example, in the main teaching that the Buddha gave around mindfulness, he said we should cultivate an awareness of what's happening inside and what's happening outside. So there is this exploration of relationship in all aspects of the Eightfold Path. And one of the famously quoted words of the Buddha is, it's a time when the Buddha's attendant, Ananda. Ananda's a really delightful being. He's often making these energetic statements about how much he loves the practice and how great it is that he's, that he has this relationship with the Buddha, and the Buddha loves Ananda and loves his enthusiasm, but he's often shading and correcting what Ananda says a little bit. And so Ananda came to the Buddha and said, "Venerable sir, I see this is half of the holy life, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." And the Buddha responds, "Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda, that is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When one has a good friend, then it is to be expected that one will develop the Eightfold Path. So the entire path begins through friendship and connection. It would be a rare individual who could go off into seclusion by themselves and figure this out for themselves. It's said that the Buddha was one of those individuals, and yet the rest of us need a good friend. We need a friend to begin this journey, to hear the information, to hear some of the teachings, to hear this shift of perspective. So what is a good friend? The Buddha talks about this too. I'll read this section. A friend should be followed when this friend possesses seven factors. What seven? The friend gives what is difficult to give, does what is difficult to do, patiently endures what is difficult to endure. One reveals one's own secrets. One keeps your secrets. The friend keeps your secrets, and does not abandon you in misfortune, does not despise one because of one's loss. So some of these are kind of things that we would think of normally in a friend. The reveals, you know, a friend, if we have a good friend, a friend will entrust us with their confidence, with their secrets. They will trust us with their secrets. So a good friend has that trust in us. And a good friend is trustworthy with our own confidences. So those are qualities that we can recognize in friendship. Does not abandon one in misfortune. That's a good friend. Someone who's willing to be there when you're having difficulty. Does not despise one because of one's loss. That's an interesting way to phrase something. Despise one because of one's loss. That one, you know, you could imagine, you know, there's so much about, I'm just trying to imagine, you know, a way that might happen in this culture. I'm not sure what it was talking about in the Buddhist culture, but in this culture, you know, the our relationships with people can be very related to external things, such as, you know, a job one has, or a particular living situation, or imagining if you have a friend who loses a job, you know, you might recognize that some of what that loss of the job is related to external conditions and some related to internal conditions. And, you know, there might be some sense of, you know, despise is a strong word, but, you know, I have seen people get really frustrated. It's like, you know, pick yourself up, you know, get on with it, you know. And so there can be a conflict in the relationship when somebody else has a loss. So, you know, looking at that in your own life, you know, how are you when somebody else has a loss? How are you with them? I think these qualities here are both qualities to look for in a friend and qualities to explore in ourselves. How are we in friendship? The first three, I think, are interesting. Now, I'll read them again. A friend gives what is difficult to give, does what is difficult to do, and patiently endures what is difficult to endure. Gives what's difficult to give. What do you think? What might that mean? Gives what's difficult to give. How might that be a quality of a good friend? Yeah. Comes to visit you
when they're tired.
When they're tired.
And say you're sick or something.
So when they're not feeling well, they would put out, essentially.
This may be a lot to ask, so we wouldn't ask a friend to come.
And without tired, asking, yeah. You know, come. Yes. Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. A good friend. I lost my train of thought. A good friend gives without expectation of return.
Gives without expectation of return. So that's does what is difficult. Gives
that,
what is
that
difficult
seems
to
like
give.
Something that's difficult.
Difficult to give. Yes.
Difficult to give.
It is difficult to give generously without expecting return. Uh huh. Yep. That's beautiful. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was thinking a good friend gives, like when one person's having a bad day and maybe isn't so kind and indeed might even be a little hurtful, that a very good friend can tell that that's because this person is down that day or maybe had a loss, like you said. And
uh-huh. So gives, in that case, when it is difficult to give.
Very difficult.
In the face of animosity, is able to be there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And not strike back.
Yes. Uh-huh. That's beautiful. So one thing I thought of, and we'll go through each of these three. One thing I thought of, gives what's difficult to give. We give the best of ourselves. You know, give the best we have to offer. That's one of the reflections I had around that one. How about the second? Does what is difficult to do. A friend does what's difficult to do.
Yeah. I think, it also related to the first one, just giving someone's time, my time, and being able to listen to where they're having problems or suffering and not having to fix it. You know, just being able to sit and hold that and to listen and not try to go immediately into fix-it mode.
That, I think, is difficult for us to do sometimes. And why is it difficult for us to do that?
I think it's hard to be with suffering.
Yep, exactly. And this relates to the third one, endures what is difficult to endure. I think all three of these are related in a way, you know, that gives what's difficult to give, gives our patience, gives the best of ourselves, does what is difficult to do, actually stays there in the face of animosity or stays there in the face of suffering without flinching, and endures what is difficult to endure. You know, so much when we're in relationship, I think one of the things in relationship that we're not so aware of sometimes is, and this is where that practice of mindfulness, of awareness of what's happening inside is so helpful, because when we are faced with suffering, when a friend is suffering, we feel it. We feel the suffering inside. It's not just them that's suffering. The resonance that we have with people, we feel it. And if we are uncomfortable with feeling that, we're going to want to fix them so we don't have to feel this. And that's a very common kind of thing to happen. You know, so much I know, we recognize this when we go to somebody and it's like, you know, we're having a hard day, you know, and we just really want somebody to listen, right? We just want somebody to be an ear and to just hear us. And often some, you know, friends will go into, well, here's what you should do, you know, and it's like, you know, that's not what I was asking for, you know. So there's so much potency and power to being able to listen and to be able to be comfortable enough with your own discomfort in the face of suffering, to be able to be someone who can give what is difficult to give, do what is difficult to do, and endure what is difficult to endure. I think this too, these three relate to perhaps the Buddha's sense of what he was doing. He was offering the Dharma, giving the Dharma. And his very first reflection on when he thought about teaching what he had understood was, people aren't going to understand this. This is hard to understand. It's subtle. And yet, he taught it anyway. And so, you know, that kind of, his reflection was, people aren't going to understand that, and that's going to be really hard. It's going to be hard to offer that in the face of people not understanding it. And so he gave what was difficult to give. Does what's difficult to do. Some of the stories in the suttas give a sense, I mean, it's not so much in the suttas, but in the books on the code of conduct, the monastic code of conduct. There's a stack of books on how the monks were relating to each other, and it's a series of stories about how people were doing things. You know, there's a story about a guy who didn't rinse the bowl in the latrine, you know, after using the latrine, and somebody else came to him and said, you know, you should have done that, and that was an offense. And he said, oh, I didn't realize that. And he said, well, okay, if you didn't realize it wasn't an offense. But this other guy goes off and then tells people, hey, he doesn't even know when he's making an offense or not. And it just flared up into this huge problem over a bowl of water in the latrine. And so the Buddha dealt with these things. You know, this apparently was a months-long dispute in the Sangha. Months and months that it took to settle this one out. And the Buddha patiently endured. He actually did have to leave at one point. He tried, he talked to them, he tried to make peace between these two factions. And at some point, they said, why don't you just go away? And so the Buddha left. And that is, in fact, a teaching that the Buddha basically said, you know, you're not able to be worked with here. So, over time it did work itself out. But there are stories and stories and stories and stories like that of how the Buddha worked with community and worked with conflict resolution. There's a lot in the texts around that, and so. You know, when I read that part of the teaching, it's like, wow, you know, he was a master negotiator and creator of community in a way, and enduring what's difficult to endure. I mean, enduring the conflict, you know, the willingness to sit in the crucible and endure the conflict, and not just, it's at times he would go off and be by himself, but so much, he sat right in the middle of it. And so that's a friend who's willing to like hang in there, even when there's conflict, even when there's struggle, just to see if we can find a way to meet. Another exploration around friendship is what kinds of friends should we associate with? So a different kind of framing of friendship. One associates with people who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, generosity, and wisdom, converses with them and engages in discussions with them. One emulates them in regard to their accomplishment in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. So this is kind of bringing in the question of friendship as being a way that we learn, you know, that we find good friends and model ourselves after them. The Buddha did, you know, he did suggest good friendship, good companionship, as a very helpful support for so many aspects of our practice. That and there's one teaching, one of my favorite texts, that the Buddha describes the path of practice as being modeling yourself after people who are wise. And so if you see that people who are wise don't engage in quarrels and disputes, for instance, then that's a practice not to engage in quarrels and disputes. If you see that a person who's wise walks peacefully through a village, you practice walking peacefully through a village. So it's kind of like modeling what you see, the behavior, the engagement in community, you model that. So there's some qualities there. Virtue, faith, generosity, wisdom, that are worth looking at. In particular, I think generosity is a real connecting quality. Giving connects, it connects giver and receiver, this aspect of generosity. And the question of, you know, are you expecting something in return? Can create a little bit of a split there. There's one text that suggests that if you're having a difficult time with somebody, you should give them a gift. And that's interesting, you know, to have the idea of, you know, actually not, and if you give, you really give somebody a gift, you're reflecting on what they might appreciate. And it shifts your whole relationship to the person to do that kind of reflection. So generosity is a connecting quality. There's another exploration. I'm kind of just skimming through here, but another place the Buddha was talking about friendship. And actually, this story apparently occurred right after he decided those people who are having this months-long dispute, they can't, you know, they told him to go away, so he went away. And this teaching, this discourse, apparently happened very soon after that. And he came upon three monks that were practicing together. And basically his first question is, I hope that you're all living in concord. With mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. So that's his first wish for these three monks who are living together. And they said, surely we are doing this. We are living in concord, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And so he asks them, so how are you doing that? You know, and so they give, so he lets them express their own wisdom around this. And they say, we practice, we maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards each other. We maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards each other. We maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards each other. We consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? So, loving kindness here is another quality that connects us. And again, here, it's a practice. You know, this is something, this is a place that I think is, in our culture, for some reason, we have this idea that if we are feeling something, it's false if we act in some other way. You have that kind of sense, you know, it's kind of like if one is feeling anger or frustration, then our truth and the way we're supposed to be is to express that. At least I've had that sense in our culture that, you know, it's like we're not being true to ourselves. There's this sense of the individual being primary, and it's like, this is my truth and I need to express it. And here, the Buddha is actually suggesting, or that the teaching is expressing, if there is this feeling inside, see if you can express acts of kindness. So how might that not be a conflict? I think what we think, one of the things, one of our relationships to this idea of needing to be true to ourselves, is that we think if we are feeling one way and acting another way, that we are repressing or denying how we're feeling. And in my own exploration of this, what I've seen is that the power of this kind of practice, the power of expressing something that's not the way I'm feeling inside, happens when I fully acknowledge the truth of how I feel inside and act with the intention of cultivating, I mean, act fully knowing, like for instance, if I'm feeling angry or frustrated, act fully recognizing, yep, there's frustration here, and yet I'm going to act with kindness, with the hope of cultivating kindness, not repressing the frustration. In fact, the opening to the frustration is an internal act of kindness. So that's cultivating kindness. And when I've done this, it's amazingly powerful to, it's walking a very fine line. We have a really strong habit of repressing if we are not acting out of a feeling. It's like, oh, I have to squash this feeling. And so it's an art almost. It's like learning to be a very good actor and yet not squashing the feelings, you know, to fully allow the feeling of frustration or impatience or whatever you're feeling, and yet see if it cannot leak out into your actions. Even just not having it leak out into your actions or tone of voice or gestures can have a very strong impact on our hearts. So this is a practice. It's not saying you should feel kindness when you're not feeling it, but cultivate it through the acts of kindness. Acting kind cultivates inner kindness through this, through a factor of intention in the mind, that there's the intention to act in a kind way that like rebounds on the heart. That rebound is most effective, or the rebound has the most place to land when we are not repressing what we're feeling. It's fully allowing and owning, yep, there's frustration here, and let me see if I cannot let that leak out through the wish of cultivating kindness. Play with it. See what happens. So kindness as a practice of friendship, really, practicing kindness as a practice of friendship. What else? A couple other pieces often mentioned in here is virtue, a virtuous friend. That virtue is a quality of a good friend. Ethical conduct is a quality of a good friend. That's something that's sometimes difficult to give, our ethical conduct. The standard formation of, or statement of ethical conducts is very similar in Buddhism as it is in some other religions, about things to refrain from doing, refraining from killing, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from acting out of harm in sexuality, refraining from lying, refraining from clouding the mind with intoxicants. So the again, it's actions that we're refraining from. And some of our culture, you know, we chafe at the bit here in the West when we're told what not to do. And the framing really of these, of virtue, has to do with connection and non-harming. So it's, it again, this exploration of not of ethical conduct is about relationship, about creating a container in which people feel safe. It's a lot about safety. And the that's one of the great gifts. This is another one of those things, gives what's difficult to give. It is said that someone who holds to these precepts gives the gift of fearlessness to countless beings and gives the gift of, or the joy, the bliss of blamelessness to themselves. So it creates both an inner and outer impact. When we are safe beings, people feel safe with us, and that is such a gift. We talked a little while ago about being willing to listen as a friend. And I think our inner practice of mindfulness gives us some of the skills we, our inner practice of mindfulness begins to help us become more comfortable with our own inner struggles and to learn how to meet those without always needing to fix or change, but somehow trusting that the witnessing allows some kind of transformation to happen. And often that transformation connects us to these beautiful qualities of love, of compassion, of kindness, that as we explore where we are stuck, the witnessing brings those qualities along and sometimes reveals underneath that the whole reason that we're stuck is because there is a deep wish for safety and connection and kindness, and there's a fear about not being able to find that connection. So much of our inner life is also about relationship. So this exploration of our inner world through finding, can we be present for our own inner life? That presence that we cultivate inwardly can be a gift outwardly. We talked about that just a few minutes ago, about what a gift it is to not have to fix or change someone when they're coming, not have to offer advice. If you find yourself getting ready, this is a great practice. If you find yourself getting ready to offer advice, see if you can pause. See if you can check in. Really, why is it that I want to give this advice? Now, some of it probably does have to do with wishing that the other person not be suffering. And yet, a good portion of it probably has to do with wishing that they're not talking about it anymore. You know, you want them to say, oh, yes, that's a great idea. I'll go off and do that. And then they stop talking about it. So, there's the discomfort with being with the suffering. And so our own presence with ourselves and the becoming comfortable with our own states of inner wobbliness and contraction makes it more possible for us to witness and be present for others. And that presence is one of the most powerful gifts that we can give. That's also, I think, a gift that's difficult to give. That it's really an equanimous mind, a mind that is non-reactive in the face of suffering, is such a rare thing in this world that. And it's contagious. You know, it can be contagious when we can meet someone suffering without reactivity. It helps them meet it without so much reactivity, and then allows a kind of deepening there. So again, this connection, this relationship. I'll talk about one more text and then open it up for more discussion. I've been kind of talking about this inner connection and outer connection. And there's another kind of famous sutta, a famous story. The Buddha tells a story about acrobats. Some of you have probably heard this story. And there are two acrobats. There's a master acrobat and an apprentice acrobat. And the story goes that the master acrobat says, "Climb the bamboo pole and stand on my shoulders." And when you do that, the master acrobat said, "You protect me, and I'll protect you. And that way we will come down safely from our acrobatic practice together." And the apprentice acrobat said, "Actually, that's not the way I see it. If you protect yourself and I protect myself, we'll come down safely from this acrobatic practice." And the Buddha confirmed in this teaching story, the Buddha said, yes, it's true. Actually, he confirmed both sides. But he started by pointing, protecting oneself, we protect others. And he pointed to the practice of mindfulness being that protection. And so we learn what it means to be present for our own experience. And he says, how is it that by protecting oneself, one protects others? By the pursuit, development, and cultivation of mindfulness, in such a way when one protects oneself, one protects others. So how might that be? Just a sec. Protecting ourselves through mindfulness, how does mindfulness protect us in the first place? That's a good question. So how does mindfulness protect us? Yeah. I'm sorry? We do not step into the rug. Oh, the rat. Oh, into the rut. Okay, we do not step into the rut. That's, yes. So with mindfulness, we see our own reactivity and can potentially not go there. We can see our inclination towards doing something harmful and not go there. Yeah.
With mindfulness, if we're staying in our own selves in the present moment, we're staying in, there shouldn't be much fear. It should just be about what is at this moment. We don't have the time or the mindset to think about the future or the past and react to all of this.
So the comment about with mindfulness, we're in the present, and so there's not the reactivity to past and future. I would agree with that, and I would also clarify a little bit, because you said we don't have the time to think about past and future when we're mindful, and if that's our perspective on mindfulness. There's a lot of life that's out of bounds from mindfulness. And it's possible to be mindful of recognizing we're thinking about the past, mindful of recognizing we're thinking about the future, and know that that's what's happening in the present moment. So that it's yeah, go ahead.
Well, if we know we're armed with the ability to stay with what is instead of reacting and doing things that might
make us become unsafe or our environment.
Exactly. So if we're aware that what's happening is that we're thinking about the past or the future, there is the possibility to not be reactive to it in our habitual ways, basically. Yes, and so there's less fear, there's less reactivity. Mindfulness makes us safer beings in that way. And so, yes, we are protecting ourselves from the we're protecting ourselves from the states of fear, of reactivity. We experience those as suffering. We're protecting ourselves from doing something that might create a lashback. You know, if we're mindful, we may be recognizing, oh, what I'm getting ready to say is something that's going to be like, you know, not so welcome on the other end, and we through mindfulness don't say it, we protect ourselves from getting the lash back. So there's so many ways that protecting ourselves with mindfulness, it protects others from our own messiness, and it protects us from the ways people would react to that messiness. So it's very reciprocal.
It allows us to be the best we can be. And I heard you say that earlier.
Yes.
I mean, it just allows us to be with what actually is going on without it being clouded.
Yes.
And then we can do what the situation requires.
Exactly.
More clearly.
Yes. Anyone else? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, the directive to protect yourself from it reminds me very much of the directive on airplanes where they always say... they always say, in the case of loss of oxygen, place the oxygen mask on yourself before you place the oxygen mask on your child. Most parents, especially mothers, are going to place the oxygen mask on their child first, and they're always saying on the airplane, don't do that. Put the oxygen mask on yourself first.
Indeed, and that's a good example of protecting yourself. You can then protect others. And so from that place of protecting oneself with the capacity of mindfulness, we become a better protector of others. So beautiful. Anyone else? Yeah. Uh-huh. Over here.
I'm struggling with this because I understand about mindfulness and keeping and hold, being able to hold one's own drama in check. And yet, when I look at my friends, Gil will never be a friend. He's a teacher. He holds it in check, and that's the right thing. But my friends, if they're messy, they're messy, and I appreciate that they're messy because I feel messy too.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives me a chance to not feel like I am the only messy person in the world.
Uh-huh.
And also a chance to reflect on our universal dukkha.
Uh-huh, yes.
And I wouldn't want to be sitting in the presence of a friend that handles it all and handles it with great, you know, ease and clarity. You know, I go to Gil for that, or to you. But what a friend to me is somebody that is like, I will show you my hurt if you will show me yours, and let's be there with each other.
And that's yes, that is a friend. And I mean, I think partly, the honesty to be where you are is part of friendship. The honesty, I mean, it's like sometimes we get this idea of, okay, being a spiritual friend means, oh, I'm so spiritual. I'm perfectly fine with your problems. Why don't you be calm? You know, we get this kind of we put on our spiritual cloak. And, you know, people go, ooh, to that. You know, it's like that. We feel the rub of that. There's a difference between, that to me, when I see people doing that, I often feel like they are repressing the inner stuff in order to put on this cloak of spiritual friend. And, so that walking that fine line of not acting out. I mean, so for instance, you might with your, I mean, just the way you said it was beautiful. It's like, yeah, like we're both struggling. We keep each other's confidences. That was one of the qualities of a good friend. One reveals one's secrets. One keeps confidence for one's other's secrets. And we meet each other with as much kindness and compassion as we have. And the not acting out is the not trying to fix or change based on my own struggle, my own reactivity, but the willingness to, okay, yeah, I can relate to that. So that I don't see a conflict there. And you know, the other piece of this too, I mean, the next piece of it, so there was the, by protecting ourselves, we protect others. You know, in that case of recognizing, yep, I've got hurts, my friend has hurts, the practice of mindfulness protects myself from amping up that hurt, you know, as best we have access to, and allows us to recognize, yeah, time for me to get some support here from a friend. So
well, a lot of times my conversations are, you know, we take turns being the broken one.
Uh-huh.
And so often it ends with the, you know, well, I guess we just have to let it go, you know, and it seems like it evolves into its own place of wisdom.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So that's when you have a good friend that you can have that kind of exchange with, it's not the kind of friend that's saying, oh, let me fix you, change you, let me figure out how this is, you know, it's more of an exchange, it's more of a back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that is a good friend. Yeah. Yeah.
Did the Buddha have anything to say about friendships between men and men, or a man and a man, or a man and a woman, or two women?
He mostly talked pretty generically. You know, some of the times he was, I mean, a lot of the stuff he was talking about was relationships between people in the Sangha, and so, you know, often there were men living together with men, women living together with women, but there were also times when they were all in community together. So I think it wasn't, I don't think he made so much, in terms of friendship, too much of a distinction about that I know of. He did at times talk about how one should relate to a husband or a wife, and that's a different topic.
The reason I ask is that my observation is that most of the men I know have very few friends, and many of the women I know have a lot of friends and act more friendly. Women act more friendly to one another. They seem to value those friendships more.
This may be cultural.
It could be.
One more piece before we go to more questions. So he says, by the pursuit, the development, cultivation of mindfulness, by protecting oneself, one protects others. How is it that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and compassion. It is in such a way that by protecting others, one protects oneself. And so this brings the other side of it. This may speak more to your question. You know, it's not just about, oh, let me be completely mindful. It's also about cultivating the qualities of patience, compassion, and harmlessness, and loving kindness. That the expression in friendship of our mindfulness is those qualities. It's not some, you know, non-reactive stance. So the expressions of patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and sympathy protects others. I mean, the orientation with those qualities is the relationship. And so that's where the protection of others is carried out. When we act with compassion, act with harmlessness, act with kindness, act with patience, it creates a container in which others feel safe and in which others can feel protected. And in doing that, we are protecting ourselves as well. So it's this reciprocal relationship. So that was the last piece I wanted to get in there. So
I was going to concur with Bill about being harder to make friendships with men, sadly, I've found it easier to do when I've lived in parts of the world where I was in a political or religious minority, which is not true here. But I think there's ways to do it if you just sort of have to apply yourself harder.
That's a very interesting observation. I'm curious about. I mean, it's something to follow up on at some point, but just what you said is that you found it easier to cultivate relationships when not in the majority.
Three of my best male friends are friends I made living in Ohio.
It comes to mind that these qualities of a good friendship can help you delineate between a person who's an acquaintance and a person who is really a friend. And that's something that I've been learning recently. People I thought were a friend really didn't come through for me with loving kindness and patience and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in reflection on that friendship, I've had to say, you know what, this person is an acquaintance because there's lack of depth in the friendship.
In the connection, uh-huh. Yeah, I think there's truth to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I have a practical question, if I may.
Sure.
I often come to this situation where I set a meeting time with a friend. It's actually not a lot of time that I have to meet with a friend. But a friend may cancel on a very short notice. Like yesterday, I had a friend and we agreed in advance, but then it came up that her daughter has a rehearsal. And it happens very often, and it kind of breaks my heart because I do treat their time as valuable. But so I understand it's sort of not a friend, maybe more an acquaintance. So should I eliminate acquaintances from my life, not to be hurt like that, not to set appointments with them? So I'm like thinking how to protect myself and my time, because as a matter of fact, I had it scheduled for her on my calendar so I can actually be present.
Yeah. I think part of it is, part of it is the breaking of the heart. I'm wondering where that comes from, is it, what's your name?
Susan.
What Susan was saying about distinguishing friendship and acquaintance helps us. I mean, it's not that you would eliminate acquaintances from your life, but you have perhaps different relationships with friendships and acquaintances, and expectations are always going to create havoc in our minds. Whether they're of friends or of acquaintances, but that it might help you to recognize, this is an acquaintance. I can't have the same level. It's kind of like it's a different level of trust or a different level of relationship, and you might over time begin to recognize less investment in that relationship. It sounds in a way like there's more investment in your heart to the relationship than perhaps is on the other side, or the other person, maybe there's as much of an investment in the relationship, but it's just manifesting in a completely different way. So I would look more in that situation with, you know, what's going on inside around the feeling like it breaks your heart. And, you know, in terms of the exploration with that friendship, would it be possible for you, or does it feel safe for you to have a conversation with that person and say, you know, this breaks my heart when this happens. And it happens a lot. And so I wonder, you know, can you do that without defensiveness, without judgment, but to put it into the relationship? And if that person, I mean, if that person rises to meet that, maybe they are more of a friend than an acquaintance. You know, so, it's not just that you have to make the determination on your own. And to always check in, too, around expectations, you know.
But it still kind of bugs me that people do those things, cancel like that.
Yeah.
It's sort of, for me, I noticed that if I cancel something, once I had to cancel, something happened, I know something will go wrong. And that day, my son dropped my cell phone, so it fell into pieces. And I thought, okay, if I had met with that person, I would have avoided this. And I mean, who knows, right? But it always happens, so I try to stick to set schedule. But I'm sort of amazed that so many people don't do that.
And, I mean, just notice your reactivity around that. That, I mean, there can be that amazement, and it may be that you end up shifting your relationships around that. And you don't have to suffer over that amazement. That's the place to look. Are you suffering over that amazement? So we need to stop. Thank you. And I'll be...